Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. Today we continue our weekly series, Criminal Injustice, where we talk about the most egregious conduct of our courts and prosecutors and how justice is denied to so many people in this country. We're joined from Chicago by Kevin Gastala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we're joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. Good to have you back, guys.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, thanks for having us.
Kevin, I'd like to start with you this week. There was a troubling development in New York City, and that was an instance where a group of policemen, it looked like a half a dozen or so policemen, jumped out of an unmarked car. They were not wearing uniforms. They did not identify themselves. And they essentially kidnapped a woman off the street who was wanted on five misdemeanor counts of damaging police cameras. This is something that I think the New York City cops learned from federal agents stationed in Portland, Oregon, where they would jump out of a rental van from Enterprise Rent-A-Car and just snatch people off the street and take them into detention. Tell us a little bit about what happened in New York and the fallout from it.
And I will say that I'm a little bit surprised. I didn't think that Mayor Bill de Blasio would actually treat both as the same. But just for the record, he apparently has said he doesn't support what the police officers were seen doing, which is using the same tactic that we've seen mayors and governors throughout the United States condemn because of its violence and its brutality and what's happening and how you have no idea who these people are. I mean, actually, in the case of, I would argue that in Portland, you had more of an idea of who these people might be than you would in New York City. Because if you look at that video, you know, they're not even in military fatigues. They're not even in any gear. So, I mean, we unfortunately have a way of understanding that the stormtroopers are grabbing you and putting you in the vehicles because we've been out at protests and we've seen how the warrior cops are deployed against us. But if you look at that video, they're getting out in mostly plain clothes and some of them have body armor on, but you don't know who's grabbing you. It could be any gang that's snatching this person. Who's doing this? And I think that was the thing that was so stunning to people. The video did go viral and people spoke out because it seemed to be done in the most disruptive manner intended to instill fear. I presume they could have gotten this person, Nikki Stone, at any point and chose to do it in broad daylight in order to make some kind of an example out of Nikki.
Paul, talk a little bit about the legality of something like this. Is it legal to just snatch someone off the street if they're exercising their constitutional right to protest?
Well, you know, part of the problem we have in this country is that we don't really have like laws that protect people from the police state. To the extent that we have laws, they're a series of judicial rulings made by judges in individual cases. You know, we don't have statutes or laws. For example, we don't have any laws prohibiting torture, for example, of American citizens. We don't have any laws prohibiting the use of excessive force or lethal force against citizens. Prisoners have no right to, for example, to a certain amount of living space. We see this just across the board. I think the poverty of the American legal system and the human rights situation, especially when you contrast this, you know, with other countries, especially in Europe, that have more comprehensive human rights frameworks of laws, of the things the government can and can't do to its citizens. And it's interesting because, you know, for decades, the U.S. has exported this model of police and unmarked cars jumping out, kidnapping people. And, you know, the model, you know, U.S. advisors have trained police in dozens of countries around the world, from El Salvador to Chile to Iraq and elsewhere, in basically the fine art of kidnapping people, torturing them, and murdering them. And so I don't think it's really a big surprise that this is happening here in the U.S. so far, minus without too much of the murder and torture. Of course, Jose Padilla and other people that have had this happen to them would say otherwise. But that's kind of the problem. There's really nothing that makes this illegal. To get a determination of legality or illegality, at this point, it would require the people that have been arrested in this manner to file a lawsuit. And when it's way through the courts, then they're going to run up against the doctrine of qualified immunity, of whether or not it was clearly established or not, of whether or not this could be done. But, you know, I think it's worth noting that the U.S. Supreme Court in a case around 30 years ago, held it was okay for the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, to kidnap people from other countries and haul them in front of U.S. courts for criminal procedures. And the U.S. Supreme Court's thinking in those cases, it doesn't matter how you get the person in front of the court as long as they show up in court. And in that case, they upheld the government's effort where they kidnapped a Mexican doctor from Mexico, brought him to the United States and put him on trial for the murder of Enrique Camarena, a DEA agent in Mexico. And ultimately, the doctor was also tortured in the process, was ultimately acquitted and found factually innocent of having any involvement in the death. But at the end of the day, though, the U.S. Supreme Court says it's okay to kidnap people, that, you know, kidnapping isn't banned by extradition treaties because it's not mentioned. And so I think that, you know, kind of looking at that type of legal framework that we have in this country, I think it's kind of an open question as to whether or not unmarked police in unmarked vehicles hopping out, grabbing people off the street and hauling them away is or isn't legal, because we don't have laws about this stuff.
Well, I just wanted to add quickly that as far as the NYPD goes, we had in the past week, and I think it is connected, the release of thousands upon thousands of police misconduct complaints that they've been fighting for. And we don't need to get into the big story, but when you look at the data set, I think it just shows that this kidnapping is basically just a glimpse at what the NYPD knows it can get away with.
Yes, I think that's true. And they have gotten away with so much for so many years. This is a setback for them. I want to talk about something that happened in New Jersey, Paul. A detainee died there while begging for water. I saw this at Prison Legal News. I also saw it in the mainstream media. This prisoner had been arrested, was begging for water for a period of hours, and then died of thirst. How could that happen?
Unfortunately, this happens all the time in this country. I'm very sad to say that here in the United States, that the news reporting that we see, that we report in Prison Legal News, we have entire whole categories on our website of American prisoners that have died of thirst, that have thirst / dehydration, that have died of starvation, that have died of exposure to the cold, that have died of exposure to the heat. You know, these are just such basic things that American prisoners are routinely deprived of and are dying of on a regular basis. And unfortunately, I mean, in this case, the prisoner's name was Mario Taruso, and this happened in September of last year. And I think that the critical thing was the prisoner in the jail who reported this to the media was a guy named Alan Wright. And he knew Taruso from outside the jail. And his description in the media was that Taruso was sweating profusely and heaving every 30 to 60 seconds while begging two jail nurses for water. And the thing that's just so common that permeates so many of these stories is the next sentence. The nurses were laughing and accusing Taruso of feigning illness in order to be taken to the hospital. And basically, Taruso went on for another hour without receiving any medical attention. Then he was eventually taken to an ambulance and he died. And I think that that's kind of this callous indifference to the lives and the suffering of prisoners is unfortunately one of the very common things that we see day in and day out around the country. And I think this is the context that we think about, especially as we think about what's happening with COVID and the pandemic and hundreds of thousands of Americans outside of prison and jail dying for a lack of medical attention. Like, what other situation do you have medical staff when someone is in obvious medical distress and showing obvious signs of a medical emergency? Are the nurses laughing at them and saying, you just want to be taken to the hospital? And I think that's the critical thing. Any other circumstances, if someone is in a medical emergency or thinks they're having a medical emergency, they can get themselves to the hospital and they can let medical staff who actually are interested in their well-being make that decision. And in this case, Mario Taruso died because of that. He was also coughing up blood. And I think that's one of those things that whether or not you think people feign illness or not, I don't know of anyone that coughs up blood feigning illness. Maybe if you're coughing up blood, you are ill. And again, this is one of those common stories of everyday life in the American prison and jail system.
Kevin, there was a fascinating piece in the Los Angeles Times yesterday about the LAPD SWAT unit. This is the same SWAT unit that that there was a TV series about, and what great camaraderie it was and how well they worked together. But it's something more like a mafia, according to the LA Times. Tell us about that.
Yes, so Sergeant Kim Colomi, and I think it's appropriate we're recording this show. I know that it's not necessarily going to be heard then, but we're recording this on National Whistleblower Appreciation Day. So I think it's good to get something like this into this week's broadcast. So Sergeant Kim Colomi was a SWAT supervisor for 11 years, and he's now left after facing retaliation from this tactical unit. And he says that his comrades were basically, they dubbed themselves the SWAT Mafia. According to Colomi, that's how they viewed themselves. And the quote is that they glamorized the use of lethal force and directed the promotions of officers who share the same values while maligning the reputations of officers who do not. So people who would de-escalate, he says, were labeled cowards and they were not promoted. People who were thugs, essentially, if we're going to carry that to its logical conclusion, they were promoted within the SWAT Mafia. This is a unit that has had a rich history of allegations and criminal misconduct, accused of being involved in that kind of conduct. Colomi says that they were aware of this series and systemic problems that were going on. And as of right now, this unit actually has been charged with falsifying information from interviews with supposed gang members out in LA. Also, it was forced to cut back on its operations because it was embarrassed, as the LA Times exposed the degree in which it was disproportionately targeting Black drivers in LA with their operations. And so this is, I think, colors our understanding of what this SWAT unit is like in LA. And obviously probably reflects a culture of urban or major city SWAT units across the country. I bet it's the case in Chicago, in New York, in probably Orlando, Florida, Houston, Texas. I mean, these SWAT units in these big cities probably think that they have a lot of leeway to run things, engage in raids, and be a mafia towards whoever they are cracking down upon.
Paul, is this a common kind of thing? Does this happen elsewhere, or is this unique to big city SWAT teams?
I think it's pretty common everywhere. You know, I think that one of the things that happens is that in bigger cities, there's a little bit more media coverage and there's a little bit more attention being paid to this stuff. But when you look at the abuses and that happen in literally small town America, where, and I think it's interesting, is looking at the evolution of how this whole SWAT thing started, because Los Angeles was actually literally the first city in America to deploy a SWAT team at the height of the Vietnam War. And the theory was that faced with political resistance, the police needed to basically be able to engage in counterinsurgency tactics. And they brought back these tactics from Vietnam of a heavily militarized, heavily armed police units to, quote, deal with special circumstances. And this is, and what was supposed to be very much of a special set of police forces in the largest cities, pretty much it spread to pretty much every town in America has a SWAT team. And it's just been this huge boondoggle of weapons and policing. And but also, I think it's also the mentality that leads to the massive use of force. I mean, I see pictures showing SWAT teams in little towns in Louisiana and Georgia. You know, the police are all suited up in body armor with helmets and automatic rifles, and they have tanks. You know, and I think it's also one of those things is that I think anyone's familiar with bureaucracies will say that if you give bureaucrats toys, it's really a lot to expect them not to use it. And so these SWAT units that were originally set up to deal with other hostage situations or urban guerrillas or heavily armed criminals or whatever, the reality is then you find out that they're serving warrants for, you know, $5 drug deals. We've gotten into this daily use of these heavily militarized police units, and they leave a body count behind them. Yeah, there's very much, you know, they use flashbang grenades. They use a lot of devices that are more appropriate for a battlefield than for our communities. And they kill a lot of people. And this has kind of become institutionalized in American policing in the last 40 years. But one of the things I find interesting is about, you know, to raise this issue about the Los Angeles. When Los Angeles, every 3 or 4 years, there's some major type of scandal about police gangs, whether it's the Ramparts gang, some type of police unit in Los Angeles is usually engaged in some high level of criminal activity. Either for years, their special investigative services operated as a death squad. They killed dozens of suspects. They would tail criminals they thought were about to commit crimes, waited until they were committing crimes, and then gunned them down without or trying to arrest them. And these are things that the Los Angeles Police Department has been doing literally for decades. Anyone who's a fan of police, you know, fiction, I say that in quotation marks, should check out Joseph Wambaugh. He's a former LAPD cop who's made a very lucrative living basically writing about thinly fictionalized stories about what the LAPD is like. They run murder for hire rings, arson for hire rings, prostitution rings, all this by active duty LAPD officers over the last 30 or 40 years. And the amazing thing is it's all extremely well documented. You know, I mean, no one really disputes it or claims that it's not true. And yet it just goes on and on and on. And decade after decade, it's almost like the Los Angeles Times and other media outlets are just rewriting the same story. The only thing that changes sometimes are the names of the police perpetrators. But the overall themes are pretty much the same.
Oh, boy. Kevin, I want to go back over to you. There's been a lot in the news lately about this young girl, 15 years old, who didn't do her homework and was sent to juvenile detention facility because she didn't do her homework. We talked about it a little bit last week. She appealed, and the appeal was denied. The warden said that, no, she belongs in detention, and she's getting a lot out of being in detention.
So in the last week, we've seen protests that have been ongoing by young people. I presume people who may even be going to school with Grace. Always, we don't know the exact identity of this girl because she is a minor and can only be identified in court by her middle name. But Grace is in juvenile detention. I imagine that there might be some students who know her who are protesting for her, or they realize that this is unjust and they are standing up because, you know, they're not in school. And so they have the time to do this. And I think rightfully so. One of the people who protested called it ridiculous because there are other students who did not do their homework during this time and they didn't go to jail. So, you know, beyond the fact that someone who doesn't do their homework shouldn't go to jail, you have the fact that it's being unequally applied. And people who are students can see that clearly. And so they don't believe in this system of punishment and they don't see it as fair in any way. And I think that what is happening here is perhaps the silver lining is that there's a lot of people who are waking up to how illegitimate this system is for detaining and controlling young children who are in school and using punishment as a way to force them to engage in certain behaviors or to force them to, I mean, using incarceration to change them is not going to work. And it's making it worse for someone like Grace, who should be allowed to be with her mother. But this court is stepping in and saying that she's a danger to her mother and needs to be separated, while at the same time making these very offensive claims like being in a detention center, especially right now during a pandemic, being in a detention center is good for her and she's going to blossom into a better student while she's in this detention center. I think that it really highlights how we use our detention centers, whether it's for children or adults, in order to paper over a lot of our worst social problems, because everything that Grace is dealing with are things that stem from poverty and struggling to survive. And yet, instead of doing anything meaningful to help her with that, we're saying, well, we'll just throw you into this detention center and punish you and make you feel bad about yourself rather than trying to help you in a time when you're really vulnerable. I mean, she's 15 years old and we need to help teenagers to grow and become adults rather than stunting them. Because I think putting them in detention centers really stunts any likelihood that they're going to grow into functioning adults.
Oh, I would agree. I would agree. Paul, you have a piece in Prison Legal News about high school journalists garnering national attention by exposing their school's use of prisoner labor. That was absolutely stunning to me. Now, we've talked about prison labor being essentially modern day slavery on the show in the past, but how can a school use prison labor?
Well, really easily, because, you know, I think one of the things that we've seen is that, you know, in this country, unfortunately, pretty much everyone in public office thinks that prison slavery and the enslavement of prisoners is a great idea. And it's interesting because when you ask, people about what they think about using unpaid convict or prisoner labor in other countries, and they think, well, that's probably a human rights violation. But what happens in this country, they think it's great public policy. And I think it's important to note that, you know, the prison slavery is happening all around us. And in this case, kids at the Amherst Pelham Regional High School in Massachusetts were literally noticing that they were prisoners from the Massachusetts Department of Corrections that were upholstering the chairs in their auditorium. And, you know, kudos to the kids. They dutifully investigated it. And it turns out that the school is paying the prison system, you know, some token amount or a very modest amount to use prison slave labor. So the prisoners come into the school, they're reupholstering the auditorium, and the prisoners are being paid literally pennies an hour for their slave labor. And I think that the more interesting thing, though, is they actually track down, if it weren't for the prisoners, for the prisoner slaves being used to do this work, who would have done this work? And they actually track down that a company called Wellspring Upholstery Cooperative had actually bid on doing the work. And Wellspring is a company that hires former prisoners and low-income people and pays them $25 an hour to do their work. And basically, the director of Wellspring said, quote, "We expected to do several school auditoriums a year, but over 5.5 years of operation, we have hardly done any." And he attributes the fact that they can't get the contracts because literally the government's using unpaid slave labor to get these contracts and do the work. And I think this is a classic case of where prison slavery undercuts the work and the wages of people outside of prison. And the irony, of course, is that for people getting out of prison, they can't find work. They can't get work because a lot of the low-skill manual labor that a lot of prisoners, a lot of people getting out of prison are well qualified for and eager to do, they can't get it because it's being done by unpaid prison slave labor. So in other words, they can do the work as long as they're being enslaved and paying pennies an hour to do it, if at all, or they just can't get it once they're out of prison. And I think this is one of the classic examples of how the American police state undermines community safety as well as the economies and well-beings of society at large. And unfortunately, the students, and good for them, they ran an essay about the situation in the school paper, The Graphic. And yeah, I think they summed it up at the end when the student said, "What's exploitive is taking that need and the want of prisoners and then paying them such minuscule wages." But again, we're stuck with a situation where pretty much everyone in public office in this country believes that enslaving people in prison is a great idea.
When I was incarcerated in the federal correctional institution in Loretto, Pennsylvania, they used, again, slave labor to make wires that were then sold to the U.S. Navy. And there was a company in the nearby town of Altoona, Pennsylvania, that also made wires that they had sold to the U.S. Navy. Well, this company was forced out of business because they were paying their workers $15 an hour or more, and the prison was paying its workers 40 cents an hour. And you just can't compete with something like that. Now, the quality was absolutely terrible, and much of the wires had to be scrapped and more had to be ordered. But the slave labor pushed a business out of business where it could have hired workers and given them a living wage to feed their families, to pay their taxes, and they couldn't. They couldn't, because you can't compete with slave labor. Paul, staying with you, I want you to explain to us, if you can, about what the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals is doing on stingray devices. We've talked about stingrays in the past, and the question before the court, the appeals court, is whether this violates the Fourth Amendment. We, I think, in the past have agreed that it does indeed violate the Fourth Amendment, but we're not appellate court judges.
This was a case where a Maryland man named Karen Andrews was wanted for attempted murder when Baltimore police used the stingray device to track him down to an apartment in Maryland. And so basically he filed a motion to suppress the contraband found with him during his arrest when the state court decided the warrant that was used to locate him was too vague because it didn't disclose the use of the stingray. So anyways, he then sued the city in federal court for conducting a search without a valid warrant. And the lower court held that the warrant was sufficient with its vague description of the stingray device and it upheld the search. But the critical thing was the district court ruling in favor of the government didn't conduct any fact-finding into the surveillance capabilities and the configuration of the stingray device and the circumstances around the warrant. So Andrews appealed, and the Fourth Circuit Appeals Court, and this is the federal appeals court that hears cases coming out of Virginia, West Virginia, the Carolinas, and Maryland, held that the lower court erred by not conducting enough of a factual inquiry. And part of that was whether or not was evaluating the reach of new technologies in protected areas, to quote the court. And one of the concerns that they echoed, which is the U.S. Supreme Court's concern, is that progress of science does not erode for Fourth Amendment protections. That was basically what the appeals court sent back to the lower court to do. Specifically, the appeals court wants to know the range of the stingray device, the number of cell devices it can monitor at once, all the data from a user's device that the stingray could intercept, how much of it was stored, and what of the intercepted data is accessible to law enforcement.
I can't help but to think that this is going to go to the Supreme Court, because this is happening all over the country. We're going to see different rulings in different courts, in different circuits. And I think that those wise men and women in Washington are going to have to make a decision. And I'm sorry that we're out of time. We were joined from Chicago by Kevin Gustala. He's a writer for Shadowproof.com and co-host of the podcast Unauthorized Disclosure. And we were joined from Lake Worth, Florida by Paul Wright. He's the executive director of the Human Rights Defense Center and the editor of Prison Legal News and Criminal Legal News magazines. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area, and in Kansas City on 104.7 and 102.9 FM and 1140 AM. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. Stay tuned to Radio Sputnik.
Loud and Clear.